phrase like right welcome. That is replaced by pretty as an intensifier. We now use pretty as a hedge, not an intensifier. And then pretty by the 16th century is replaced by very. Since then, really has come to prominence. And so now we have really and very up there as two very common, notice what I did, intensifiers. And I think for many of us, very feels probably a little more formal, really a little less formal, but not as informal as so. And so is now overtaking really in terms of its frequency as an intensifier. There has also been some attention recently to the rise of super as an intensifier. I was interviewed about this for an article in a newspaper, and to prepare for the interview, I went into the corpus of contemporary American English to see what was going on with super as an intensifier. I searched for super plus adjective and super plus adverb, and I found that super used this way is 5 times more frequent in 2010 to 2012 than it was from 1990 to 1994. So in 20 years, super has gained enormously in frequency. And I do think that at least for some of us, super fast is faster than really fast, because super fast is super fast. And that super is now, and probably part of it is because it's new, able to do this kind of intensifying work with a little more intensity. That said, as super does this kind of work more frequently, it probably will weaken and stop functioning as an intensifier that adds more impact than something like really. There are also new and slangier forms of intensifiers in American English. This would include things like hella, hella cool, uber cool, wicked cool. In British English, you get slangy intensifiers such as flipping, chuffing, dead, blooming, bloody. And it is important for Americans to remember that bloody remains an expletive, perhaps now a more mild expletive in British English. For Americans, it can seem like a harmless word. In formal writing, it is worth looking at all of your intensifiers and seeing if you need them. Let's take a sentence like, "This finding is quite remarkable." You could just take out that intensifier quite and write, "This finding is remarkable." Or take the phrase, "the very dramatic decrease." Take out that very. Just make it the dramatic decrease. And there's a way actually without that intensifier that dramatic gets to just do its work, the dramatic decrease, because dramatic is already pretty dramatic. But I want to note here that my advice to look at your intensifiers and see where you need them and often take them out does not make the case that one should omit all adverbs. And I do see that advice sometimes about writing, that you should take out all your adverbs. Adverbs do important work, and many of them are worth saving. For example, some adverbs work to boost our claims. When we say, for example, clearly, surely, obviously. Equally importantly, some adverbs can hedge our claims. Things like perhaps, possibly, arguably. Why are these important? These are important because part of academic writing is negotiating our commitments to our arguments. We're letting people know whether we're quite confident that this is true or whether this is an assertion and we need some contingencies here. We're also letting people know about our stance in terms of our assessment of other people's claims and whether or not they are valid. I think that when I talk with students sometimes about strong arguments, I realize that they interpret that to mean that this should be an argument that has no hedges, that makes strong claims and doesn't allow for exceptions, doesn't allow for uncertainty. And what we know actually is that in the academy, in academic writing, strong arguments are sophisticated in terms of where they boost their claims, where there is certainty, and where they hedge their claims, where they make space for counterarguments, for readers to disagree or raise questions for additional evidence. Let's now talk about one other controversial adverb, and this is hopefully as a sentence adverb. In the first couple of decades of the 20th century, the adverb hopefully started to be used to mean, I hope, we hope, it is hoped, in addition to its original meaning, full of hope. So, as a result, speakers could say, she smiled hopefully, as in she was full of hope, and they could say, hopefully it won't snow tomorrow. The sentence adverb use of hopefully, as in hopefully it won't snow tomorrow, which captures our general hope, gained in popularity throughout the 20th century. What happened is that in the 1960s then, as hopefully gained in popularity, prescriptive commentators noticed. And when they noticed this new use, they started to condemn it, calling it overly ambiguous. They said, we don't know who's hoping. They also said, if you get a sentence like, hopefully she opened the gift, that could be that she is opening it full of hope, or that we hope she opened it. Now, speakers have continued to use hopefully as a sentence adverb prolifically, but starting in the 1960s, the sentence adverb dropped precipitously out of edited prose. I did a search of Time magazine, in the Time magazine corpus, which you can find online, and you can search all of Time magazine from when it started in the 1920s. And when I searched on hopefully, you see a dramatic increase across the first half of the 20th century as it takes on the sentence adverb function, because the sentence adverb function is useful. And then suddenly, starting in the 1960s, it drops out of use in Time magazine. And I believe that is because the editors started noticing it, and they were told to edit it out. It doesn't fall out completely because, of course, you'll still get hopefully in quoted text because people were still saying it. The American Heritage Dictionary Usage Panel has been asked about the sentence adverb use of hopefully regularly over the years. And here's the interesting thing. For a while, the panel was getting more prescriptive about it. In the 1969 survey, 44% of the panel accepted the new use of hopefully in hopefully the treaty will be ratified. But in 1999, only 34% accepted it. In other words, the panel was getting crankier about this. But now the tide has turned. When the panel was asked again in 2012, 63% accepted the sentence, hopefully the treaty will be ratified. And I will say, I was one of those people who accepted it. And 89% accepted mercifully as a sentence adverb, as in, mercifully, the play was brief. And mercifully raises a key point. There are many other sentence adverbs in English that are fully accepted. Mercifully, fortunately, briefly, frankly, which I used in some sentences earlier in this lecture. And given how common the sentence adverb use of hopefully is in speech, it seems that whatever ambiguity there is, it's an ambiguity that speakers can accept, that we can work with. And it's important to realize that human languages are often ambiguous, and it often serves us well, at least in speech where we can clarify if something goes awry. It is true that in writing, we sometimes have to be careful because we're not there to clarify if there is ambiguity. With hopefully, the ambiguity may even be helpful. Think about the sentence, hopefully it won't snow tomorrow. I actually don't want to specify who's hoping. I mean, it's probably me, it's probably you, but it's really sort of bigger than us. It's a general hope. We're all hoping. Hopefully, it won't snow tomorrow. And this use of hopefully is coming to be accepted. You saw it with the usage panel, and in April of 2012, the Associated Press style book changed its stance and said that, okay, writers could now use hopefully to mean it is hoped or we hope. What I found interesting is that the fact that the AP style book made this decision made headlines. We are really interested in grammar. To end this lecture, let's come back full circle to those flat adverbs. Those adverbs that have the same form as their adjective counterparts. These would be words like fast, up, down, soon. You can say, for example, I am a fast eater. Fast is an adjective. I eat fast. Fast is an adverb. And we would not say I eat fastly. Fast does not like that ly ending there. But one of the common markers of adverbs is that suffix ly, which we can add to an adjective to make an adverb, at least some of the time. Quick becomes quickly. Beautiful becomes beautifully. But there are also a few adjectives that have that ly ending. Homely, comely, manly, friendly. And there's a historical reason for this. The historical source of modern ly had an adjective and an adverb form. It goes back to what would be spelled in Old English lic, pronounced leech. That would be the adjective form. And liche, with a final e, was the adverb form. Because one of the ways that Old English distinguished adverbs was that final e. Now, over time, leech or liche lost the final c, the ch, and it also lost the final e, and it turned into ly, which is how we have some ly adjectives as well as some ly adverbs. The suffix ly now is used productively to make adverbs, such as quick becoming quickly, but we have these remnants of its earlier use also to make adjectives. The fact that ly remains in some of those adjectives can sometimes put us in an awkward spot, particularly with an adjective like friendly. What is the adverb form of friendly? I greeted her friendlily. I greeted her in a friendly way. I think, to me, this gap in the language is such an interesting one because we use the word friendly on a very regular basis, and we clearly need to talk about things we do in a friendly way. How are we missing an adverb form there other than friendlily, which I think some of us think sounds a little funny? There are, though, many adverbs with no distinctive ly marking, such as soon, up, down, fast, hard, tight, slow. Wait, 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 you say. Did Anne just say that slow is an adverb? But there's slowly. There is some controversy over a phrase like drive slow. But historically, there's actually no problem here. And I think that perhaps something like go slow sounds better. There used to be a lot of flat adverbs in English because, as I mentioned earlier, English used to mark adverbs with a final E. And when the final E dropped off in the history of English, those adverbs and adjectives looked the same way. So here is an example of a flat adverb, in this case slow, from Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream. But oh, methinks, how slow this old moon wanes. How slow this old moon wanes, not how slowly. What about drive safe? This is one of those expressions that people bring up to me as one of the ones that they really don't like. Historically, the adverb here has been safely, drive safely. But why not let safe be a flat adverb? Merriam-Webster already recognizes it as an adverb. The American Heritage Dictionary and the Oxford English Dictionary do not yet. For me, I have to say there's actually a difference between drive safe and drive safely. For example, if I have people over to my home for a dinner party and they're leaving my home and I want to wish them well, I will say drive safe. It feels friendlier to me. If I say drive safely, it feels like I'm part of a campaign to make sure that people are safe on the roads. What about the expression play nice? Nice historically has been an adverb, although now that would be a non-standard use of nice. For example, in he sings really nice. So historically that would have been more standard than it is now. Merriam-Webster recognizes nice as an adverb. American Heritage Dictionary does not. And this came up for me in a question and answer session at a talk that I gave at the Ann Arbor City Club. At the City Club, there is a sign during the Bridge Club meetings that says, play nice. Play here works in kind of a funny way. We could also say play dirty and play clean. The latter, where clean is working as an adverb, is recognized in the American Heritage Dictionary. The former, play dirty, is not recognized yet. But there is precedent for saying something like play nice. Some flat adverbs mean something different from the ly form. Think about work hard versus hardly work. Clearly those mean different things. Or the expression we sometimes say at night, sleep tight. There, tight is functioning as an adverb and it means soundly, sleep soundly. Versus, could we even say sleep tightly? But we could use tightly to say lock it up tightly or lock it up tight. In some cases, the flat adverb will feel more informal or more playful, but that doesn't necessarily make it ungrammatical. Remember that flat adverbs have been around for centuries. And they can make us sometimes think that in creative ways, they can allow us to do things like eat fresh, think different. And I love that part of human language, that we can play with is something an adjective or isn't an adverb, and how does it make us think or think differently about the language? So is that a wrap on adverbs for this lecture? Absolutely. Okay, maybe not quite yet, because check out that use of absolutely to mean yes. Definitely can do the same thing. These are intensifiers that have taken on this positive connotation of agreement to become synonymous with yes. Think how weird it would be if you used absolutely to mean no. Now, is yes an adverb? That's a hard question. Yes is an adverb, and it's other things too, which we'll come back to in lecture 21 when we talk about the grammar of conversation. Before we get there, we'll talk about conjunctions in the next lecture and how different speech and writing can be when it comes to these connecting words.
Lecture 15. No ifs, ands, or buts.
A few years ago, I became very interested in, some might even say obsessed with, the Microsoft Word Grammar Checker. I started asking, where do these rules come from? And I couldn't get a clear answer. Why does this matter? It matters because the Microsoft Word Grammar Checker is arguably the most powerful prescriptive force in the world. And I'm going to make that argument. Think about it. It is on something like 90% of the word processing programs out there in the world. And it is on by default. You have to know to turn it off to make it go away. People are much more likely to encounter the rules that are in the Microsoft Word Grammar Checker than they are to encounter the rules in any particular printed usage guide, such as Strunk and White or Brian Garner's Modern American Usage. It's so easy. The rules are right there on your computer as you type. You don't even have to stand up and go to your bookshelf to get a book. And when the Grammar Checker puts a green squiggly line under something, it can make any of us wonder, what's wrong with that? And maybe I should change it. I talked about the Grammar Checker already in the lecture on relative clauses, and I'm returning to it here in this lecture on conjunctions for a reason. What is that reason? I first got interested in the Grammar Checker because it underlines and at the beginning of a sentence. What is up with that? It tipped me off that there might be some problems with the rules in the Grammar Checker. This is because this rule about not starting a sentence with and simply isn't a rule. It's a myth. Or, as H.W. Fowler put it early in the 20th century, it is a faintly lingering superstition. It's a myth or a superstition that is perpetuated by English teachers and other language mavens who are enforcing rules that in this case you can't find in any typical usage guide. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary of English Usage summarizes the situation with "and" at the beginning of a sentence this way, and here I quote, "Everybody agrees that it's all right to begin a sentence with "and." And nearly everybody admits to having been taught at some point in the past that the practice was wrong. Most of us think the prohibition goes back to our early school days. The prohibition is probably meant to correct the tendency of children to string together independent clauses or simple declarative sentences with "ands." I appreciate that explanation from Merriam-Webster. I think that it is probably true. There's a reason that kids have a tendency to use a lot of "ands" in their writing, and that's because we use a lot of "ands" when we talk. As writers, children need to learn to write in less colloquial ways. But that doesn't mean that one cannot start a sentence with "and." But before we continue with this rule about "and," let's think about the power of the Microsoft Word Grammar Checker, putting green squiggly lines under sentence initial "and" or "but." It sure makes it seem like there's something wrong with putting "and" or "but" there. If you pull up the pop-up box in Microsoft Word 10, when it underlines, for example, a sentence initial "and," you can get an explanation. And what it says is that to use "and" this way is informal. And they go on to say, although sentences beginning with "and," "but," or "plus" may be used informally, use the suggested replacement for a more formal or traditional tone. The box, the little box in Microsoft Word, then suggests that you replace "plus" with something like "in addition" or "moreover," and suggests that you replace "but" with "nevertheless" or "however." But I'm not sure that everyone makes a distinction between informal and wrong. I'm also not convinced that everyone reads the explanation in the little box. I'm also not convinced that sentence initial "and" is informal. You can find sentence initial and sentence initial "but" and "or" all over academic writing. It's in literature. It's also in the Bible. Think about, "and God said, let there be light." That's in the English translation. In informal polls that I've done, a good number of people tell me that they revise their prose until that green squiggly line in their document goes away. And what that means is that this myth about sentence initial and "but" and "or" suddenly takes on new power. In this lecture, we'll review coordinating conjunctions, which are sometimes called coordinators, and subordinating conjunctions, or subordinators, and then talk about some usage issues, such as "plus," what's going on there, "because," and "like." At the end of the lecture, I'll show you some new evidence for what the word "slash" is doing, evidence that suggests that "slash" is becoming a coordinator between clauses. In this lecture, I'll typically use the terminology coordinator and subordinator. And I want to note that there is not unanimity in the linguistics community about terminology. Jeff Pullum, who I mentioned in the lecture on passive voice, and his co-author Rodney Huddleston, who wrote the Cambridge Grammar of the English Language, have argued that we are getting the terminology wrong around coordinators and subordinators. They argue that we should think about many words that are typically called subordinating conjunctions or subordinators as prepositions, an argument that I will return to in Lecture 17. It's a really provocative and important argument. I also recognize that you will continue to encounter the terms coordinator and subordinator, as well as coordinating and subordinating conjunction in most usage guides, grammar books, and dictionaries. So I will use that categorization in this lecture. Let's start with coordinators or coordinating conjunctions, such as "and" "but." Coordinating conjunctions, coordinators, join two units of equal status. That could be two nouns, two noun phrases, two full clauses, and the like. One mnemonic that you may know to help you remember your coordinators is FANBOYS. It's an acronym, and it stands for and, nor, but, or, yet, so. Where does that acronym come from? Brett Reynolds wrote an interesting article in TESOL, Teaching English as a Second Language, TESOL Canada Journal. And what he found is that the acronym seems to come from a 1951 grammar book. And in the end, it may not be that helpful. Not everyone accepts for, yet, and so as coordinators. Let's start with a more typical coordinator. That would be and. Some people would call it a prototypical coordinator. And can coordinate words, phrases, and clauses. Let's just quickly look at examples of that. Words, an expression like apples and oranges, cease and desist, safe and sound. And connecting phrases, the young and the restless, reading books and writing essays. And then, of course, and can connect clauses. For example, my phone rang and I jumped. In relation to clauses, it's important to know that and always occurs initially in the second clause. My phone rang and I jumped. You cannot move the and around. You cannot say my phone rang, I jumped to and. Some coordinators can also take more than two coordinates. The examples I've given you have all included just two. If it takes more than two, it's something like X, Y, and Z. And if you're wondering if there should be a comma after Y in X, Y, and Z, just hang on. We'll get there in lecture 22. The key point here is that coordinators occur between the coordinates. As I said, And, for example, has to occur right between my phone rang and I jumped. Cannot be moved. And the whole clause, second clause, can't be moved. You cannot say, and I jumped, my phone rang. The and has to come between the clauses. The fact that you can't say, and I jumped, my phone rang, becomes important when we talk about subordinators. The coordinator or can do all the things that and can do. It can connect words, phrases, and clauses. It can also coordinate more than two items. In contrast, the coordinator but cannot do all of that. It can conjoin clauses. For example, she ordered a smoothie, but she doesn't like bananas. But does less well coordinating words and phrases. For example, I bought apples, but oranges. I think most of us would say that that doesn't feel entirely grammatical. That said, we can say, I bought apples, but not oranges. And I think all of us could probably also say, I saw one doctor, but three nurses. But also typically takes only two coordinates. That said, I'm not sure it's impossible to say the following. She ran, showered, but didn't eat breakfast. I don't know, maybe she didn't have breakfast because they only had bananas and she doesn't like bananas. These more prototypical coordinators also cannot co-occur. In other words, we cannot say something like the following. He loves chocolate and but it keeps him up at night. You gotta choose. You either get and or you get but. Unless, of course, you put a slash in between something like and or. For example, he should eat chocolate earlier in the day and or eat less chocolate. Given all of this, what about so and yet? So and yet are sometimes called marginal coordinators. And here's why. So, for instance, can't typically connect words or phrases. It only does clauses. We can say, they were late, so they parked illegally right in front. But we cannot say, they were late, so frantic. That doesn't work. That said, I think we might all agree that so can connect verb phrases. See if you think this is okay. They were late, so drove fast. For me, that seems pretty acceptable. So can also combine with and. And remember that but and cannot combine, but and so can combine. For example, she decided she wanted to get a PhD, and so she started doing research on PhD programs in linguistics. Yet can also combine with and. Here's a sentence. They were late, and yet they stopped to get coffee on the way. With that setup about coordinators, let's talk about the controversy surrounding the word plus. Let's start with the well-known mathematical expression, 2 plus 2 equals 4. 2 plus 2 equals 4. The S in equals suggests that 2 plus 2 as a unit is singular. 2 plus 2 equals. Some interpret this fact to mean that plus in this expression is a preposition. So plus 2 is a prepositional phrase, which allows 2 plus 2 to be singular. This is different from how and works in an identical construction. Think about 2 and 2 are 4. Right? That's what we would say. 2 and 2 are 4, whereas 2 plus 2 is 4. Plus, so there we see the argument of plus as a preposition, can also feel like a preposition in a sentence like this one. All school-age children, plus an accompanying adult, can get in for free. However, the editors of the American Heritage Dictionary reject this idea that plus is a preposition and call plus in these constructions a conjunction, what I'm calling a coordinator. And they simply state that convention means that 2 plus 2 is treated as singular. X plus Y can also be singular outside of math. For example, my love of sports plus my interest in marketing makes it a perfect job for me. That said, I think all of us could probably also make that plural. We could have a plural verb. My love of sports plus my interest in marketing make it a perfect job for me. While we're here, it's also worth noting that X and Y can be singular if it's thought of as a notionally singular unit. For example, I could say peanut butter and jelly is an excellent combination. Peanut butter and jelly, X and Y, is. That said, this isn't even the most controversial issue around the word plus. Here's the controversial part. Can you use plus to coordinate clauses or even to begin a sentence? Let's start with the use of plus to coordinate clauses. It is out there, but it's much less common than plus followed by a noun phrase, and it remains quite informal. When I searched for it in the corpus of contemporary American English, it's harder to find in newspapers and academic prose than it is in speech. But you can find it. Here's an example from the magazine Astronomy. It made for a great start to the conference. Plus, I really enjoyed seeing some old friends. Or here's an example from Esquire. The next woman, the 43-year-old, already has 2 kids, plus she's recovering from thyroid cancer. If plus can coordinate clauses, can it also start a sentence the way that and can? The answer is yes, it can, but not all critics like it. The corpus of contemporary American English shows it on the rise at the beginning of a sentence. I discovered it's about 4 times more common from 2010 to 2015 than it was in 1990 to 94. It's favored in magazines, which I think probably captures its informality. And given that, I was expecting the American Heritage Dictionary usage panel to be critical of plus at the beginning of the sentence. But I was surprised. The majority of the panel accepts it. In our 2009 survey, 67% of the panel accepted this example. He has a lot of personal charm, period, plus, comma, he knows what he's doing. 63% accepted an example expressing a negative judgment. Here's the sentence. We were a terrible team. Plus, we had bad uniforms. My guess is that we will see this use of plus increasing in ever more formal genres. With all that said about coordinators, let's now turn to subordinators or subordinating conjunctions. Subordinators connect clauses, and in the process, they subordinate one clause to the other clause, such that the subordinated clause can no longer stand alone, but depends on the main clause. This is why you'll hear the terminology independent clause and dependent clause, because the subordinator makes the clause it's in dependent on the independent clause. A prototypical example of a subordinator would be if. And here's a sentence with if in it. If it snows tomorrow, we probably won't run. We could reverse those two clauses, unlike what we could do with coordinators. If we reverse them, we would get, we probably won't run if it snows tomorrow. And the dependent clause here cannot stand alone. If I just said, if it snows tomorrow, then you would be waiting for me to be finished, to finish that sentence, because it's clear that it's dependent, something is still coming. One time it could stand alone is, for example, in response to a question. If we had the question, will you all skip running tomorrow? We could say, if it snows. With this example of if it snows tomorrow, let me quickly address the question of fragments that begin with a subordinator. It is certainly possible to have these kinds of fragments for rhetorical effect. And let me give you a passage where you can see that happening. So researchers say we might be able to stave off climate change with a 40% reduction in global emissions, period, unless the unexpected happens. You can see how isolating that dependent clause, unless the unexpected happens, can create a focus on that information. And that can be rhetorically effective. It can add emphasis. Common subordinating conjunctions or subordinators include although, because, while, when, after, before, since, unless, as if, in order that, as soon as. Most subordinators are not controversial, but because and like have raised some hackles. Let's take them in that order. There are two concerns about because, and we're going to start with this one. Can you begin a sentence with because? The answer is yes. This idea that you can't may once again come from writing instruction at earlier ages, where we're trying to help younger writers avoid fragments. If you start a sentence with because, there's some chance you might not remember to put that independent clause in later and thereby end up with a fragment. You can, however, find introductory because all over academic writing. Here's just one example from the academic journal Politics and the Life Sciences. This is from 2014. And here I'm going to quote. Because Nietzsche is one of the few thinkers to so openly and comprehensively question the very basis of conventional morality, and because Nietzsche also proposed and elaborated such a distinctive solution to the problems from conventional morality, I will refer extensively to his writings on this topic. You'll notice there that we actually have two introductory becauses. Note also the split infinitive in that passage. Did you catch it? It was right at the beginning. Nietzsche is one of the few thinkers to so openly and comprehensively question. The second concern about because is about the phrase, the reason is because, rather than the reason is that. Okay, fair enough. It is redundant to say the reason is because. It reminds me of our discussion in the very first lecture about equally as. But as I have noted before, we do accept other redundancies in standard formal prose. The editors of the American Heritage Dictionary, in their usage note, point out that people don't seem to be bothered by this similar redundancy. And here I'll quote. The last time I ate red meat was when. The last time, when. That's arguably redundant. That said, the reason is because is largely edited out of more formal writing, although you can find it. When I searched for it, I found this in the Michigan Law Review from 1998. If regulatory competition is desirable, the reason is because without it, the U.S. would require too much disclosure, not too little. Now let's talk about like as a subordinating conjunction or a subordinator. And to talk about this, we have to go back in time to a very controversial Winston cigarette ad in the 1950s and 1960s. Here's the ad. Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. This ad was criticized in newspapers and magazines and usage guides. It was criticized by people who wanted like only to be a preposition. From that time, there's a terrific quote from the New Yorker, which is quoted in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary of English Usage. And here's the quote. We hope Sir Winston Churchill, impeccable old-school grammarian that he is, hasn't chanced to hear American radio or television commercials recently. It would pain him dreadfully, we're sure, to listen to the obnoxious and ubiquitous couplet, Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. That pesky like is a problem for us Americans to solve, we guess. And anyway, Sir Winston has his own problems. But Winston Churchill was known to use like this way. The Longman Grammar of Spoken and Written English, which, by the way, is a terrific resource, that book quotes one of Churchill's wartime letters in which he's talking about special committees. And here's what he writes. We are overrun by them like the Australians were by rabbits. There you'll see that like as a subordinator. Like as a subordinator seems to go back to the 14th century. And while it wasn't common in earlier years, it does show up in Shakespeare and later in Dickens, George Eliot, Keats, Emily Bronte, as well as many others. This use of like starts to be criticized as early as the 18th century, including Noah Webster, who called the sentence, he thinks like you do, improper and vulgar. Criticism rises in the 19th century, and as Ward Gilman, who's the editor of the Merriam-Webster Dictionary of English Usage, explains, the criticism was consolidated in the 20th century to come to a consensus position that it was just plain wrong to use like to mean as if or as. Of course, if you look at literature we admire, you can find like used as a subordinator a lot. Here are just two examples. These are quoted in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary of English Usage. The first is from Carl Sandburg in Smoke and Steel, published in 1920. I can go hungry again like I have gone hungry before. And here's T.S. Eliot from Sweeney Agonistes in 1932. You wake like someone hit you on the head. In the end, what do we make of this Winston cigarette ad? I have to say, at some level, it did its job because it had people talking. Think about our discussion of think different and eat fresh. Do you want to use like as a subordinator? In the end, that's going to be your decision. But I have to say, you're in good company if you decide that you want to do so. Is it okay to use like as a preposition? Yes. Definitely. But some people seem to be scared of like as a preposition because of the criticism of like as a subordinator. Like as a preposition can express similarity. For example, Dave, like many other Ann Arborites, owns a Prius. Like as a preposition can also be used synonymously with such as. Here's an example. Our friend's daughter wants to go to a smaller school, like Oberlin. You can see there the potential ambiguity. The like there could mean such as, a smaller school such as Oberlin, or it could be used to express similarity, a smaller school similar to Oberlin. I want to end this lecture with an exciting development in the language, the potential emergence of a new coordinator between clauses. And this may have happened as early as 2005. Here's the story of how I learned about this new coordinator. When I teach my course on the history of English, I have students teach me new slang. They have to teach me two new slang words each day before I will start class. This was about 3 months into the term, and one of my students said, "Do you know what we're doing with the word slash?" And I said, "I have no idea. What are you doing with the word slash?" And here's the example sentence she gave me. "I really love that hot dog place on Liberty Street. Slash, can we go there tomorrow?" And I've got to tell you that in that, "I really love that hot dog place on Liberty Street," period, slash, written out as a word, slash, "can we go there tomorrow?" I looked at her and I said, "I cannot do that." And I turned to the rest of the class and I said, "Can other people in here use slash that way?" And more than half the students said, "Oh, absolutely." Now, students are never allowed to use phones in my class, but I made an exception and said, "Okay, pull out your phones and show me some text messages where you use slash this way." And they did. The next class, I came back for more examples because I was so interested in what was happening here. My students thought I was a little crazy. They said, "Why is this so interesting? But let me show you what's fascinating here." You can find what is the more traditional use of slash that I can do. For example, run slash walk. In other words, this is a combination of running and walking, so you can run slash walk. Or I could say, "He is my friend slash mentor." Those two descriptions refer to the same thing. That's the more traditional use of slash. But here are some of the newer uses. One way that the students that I talked to were using slash was to distinguish between what I should do versus what I'm actually going to do. Here's an example. "I'm going to go home and work on my paper slash take a nap." Or if you want what you might want versus reality. And here's one of my favorite examples from Twitter. "It was fate slash you stalked him." Slash can also be used now to mean something like following up on that, or while we're on that topic, here's another thing. I did a study searching for these on Twitter, and here are a couple of examples that I found. "When is your next tour? Slash, will you be making any pit stops in Dallas or Oklahoma City?" Here's another one. "Why are cycling shoes so expensive? Slash, why do I have to buy the clip separately?" As I said, this is written out as slash. It can come after a comma. It can come after a period. Or there can be no punctuation around it. It can just be a coordinator in between the two clauses. I ended up writing a blog post on this new use of slash, which attracted a lot of attention out there on the internet. And I have to say, the thing that made me happiest about that was that I could go back to class and tell the students, "Look, other people are interested," which gave me some credibility because otherwise they thought I was crazy to think that this was such a cool development in the language. Now, why would they be writing out slash? It seems inefficient. Well, here's one answer that was posted in response to my blog post, and it was posted by someone named Sunshine. Sunshine writes, "As a teen who uses slash in oral communication and written e-communication, I would say the main reason I spell the word out is in order for it to be seen clearly and read as slash instead of or. The two words now have a completely different meaning and function, even though they are both expressed using the same symbol." I love this informal comment from Sunshine because it captures Sunshine's very clear sense that this use of slash is different from what we might mean by the symbol. This is a linguistic innovation right under our noses, and one of the most interesting kind because it involves a function word. You'll notice that I've not talked about however in this lecture. And that is because I'm not categorizing, however, as a coordinator, but instead as a conjunctive adverb. Or at least, maybe I am. So let's turn to however in the next lecture as we think about conjunctive adverbs.
Lecture 16. However to use however.
When a writer is struggling to get an idea out onto the page, sometimes people will recommend, just say it out loud and then write that down. Or, just write it like you would say it. And I've been known to say this myself. That advice is fine as far as it gets you. It could help get that idea out of your head and onto the page or hammered out onto your keyboard. But in any formal register of writing, we should not write the way we speak. We're expected to use different vocabulary, and we're also expected to use different syntactic structures. For example, we're asked to use more subordination than we would in speech, where we tend to use a lot of coordinators. In terms of different vocabulary, it's not just that in formal writing we often use more highfalutin words. That's more obvious, and it certainly is part of, for example, academic writing. We're using the jargon of whatever field we're writing in. There are also more subtle differences. And in particular, what I want to talk about here is that we use different conjunctive adverbs in formal writing than we do in speech. What do I mean here? To show you what I mean, I'm going to tell you about some results from searches of the Corpus of Contemporary American English. As you may remember, this corpus has five registers in it. It has spoken, and then it has academic writing, newspapers, magazines, and fiction. This makes the corpus a really fun place to go play to see how different words distribute across different kinds of writing, as well as how they distribute between speech and writing. First, I went in and I searched for therefore. Therefore is far and away the most common in academic writing. It occurs 5 times more often in academic writing than in magazines or spoken language. It occurs 10 times more often in academic writing than in newspapers or fiction. What happens if you search thus? Well, of course I did that too. Thus is even more written. Again, it's most common in academic writing. It is more than 30 times more common in academic writing than in speech. In speech, we're much more likely to say something like so than we are to say thus or therefore. Or sometimes in speech, we'll just use and to show a consequence. For example, we might say, Rosie didn't get enough sleep the night before, and she didn't do well on the final exam. There, the and is capturing consequence. As I said, in speech, we tend to rely much more on coordinators like and than on conjunctive adverbs like thus and therefore. What happens if you search consequently? Well, at this point, you can probably guess. Consequently is 25 times more common in academic writing than in speech. Newspapers also don't use consequently very much. It's only about twice as common in newspapers as it is in speech. Moreover, 40 times more frequent in academic writing than speech. Even less academic-y conjunctive adverbs, or adverbials, because I'll talk about some phrases here too, even these are more common in written than spoken. For example, in addition is more than twice as common in newspapers and magazines than it is in speech. And then if you turn to academic writing, we seem to love in addition. It is 7 times more common in academic writing than it is in speech. Nonetheless, four times more common in academic writing than speech. That said, nonetheless is more common in speech than moreover, thus, and some of the other ones I've talked about. There are, however, conjunctive adverbs that pattern the other way. For example, anyway is more common in speech, though it's also quite common in fiction where you're getting a lot of quoted speech. Then is more common in speech. So we do have some more colloquial conjunctive adverbs. This seems like a good moment to back up and define a conjunctive adverb. Then we'll talk about the usage issues surrounding a few conjunctive adverbs, such as however, importantly, in particular, more important versus more importantly, and firstly. The most basic definition of conjunctive adverbs is something like this. It's an adverb that conjoins two clauses. The clauses remain independent, and they can even be separate sentences, or they can be put into the same sentence and conjoined by a semicolon. Let's take this example from an article in The Atlantic from 2015. This uses the conjunctive adverb therefore. I feel depressed, semicolon. Therefore, my marriage is not working out. Now, this could be, we could turn that into two separate clauses and put a period in there instead of a semicolon. I feel depressed, period. Therefore, my marriage is not working out. A conjunctive adverb is different from a coordinator because it can move. In the example I just gave you, the therefore was sitting right in between the two clauses, but it can move. Let me explain, and to do this, we're going to review a little bit of what we talked about with coordinators. A coordinator has to appear exactly between the two clauses, joining them from that medial position. If we take that same sentence from The Atlantic and put a coordinator in, you can see it can't move. I feel depressed, and my marriage is not working out. That and is stuck right there. The conjunctive adverb, as I noted, can appear in the same place as and, but it can also move within the second clause. So here it is right in between. I feel depressed, therefore my marriage is not working out. But it could also be, I feel depressed. My marriage, therefore, is not working out. Or we could move the therefore a little further down in the second clause. I feel depressed. My marriage is, therefore, not working out. As we talked about, adverbs are relatively free when it comes to word order, and conjunctive adverbs follow that pattern. Although sometimes we don't like them at the end of a clause. For example, I don't know how you'd feel about, I feel depressed, my marriage is not working out, therefore. You can do it, but it may not sound great to you. Why do we get such a range of conjunctive adverbs in writing? There are real benefits to conjunctive adverbs that help us as writers. They can show with specificity how two clauses are connected, with much more specificity than the more informal and but. Here's some of the semantic work that these conjunctive adverbs can do. They can add to the previous utterance. This would be adverbs such as furthermore, in addition, moreover. They can express contrast, notwithstanding, nevertheless, nonetheless, in contrast. They can illustrate. For example, for instance, they can summarize, in short, in sum. Conjunctive adverbs can also show a sequence in time or in logic. Consequently, therefore, thus. These adverbs can also emphasize words like certainly and indeed. Let's now turn to some usage issues with conjunctive adverbs, and we have to start with however. And why do we have to start with however? We have to start there given how many problems this causes writers. As a teacher of writing, I have to say, I think I spend more time trying to help students understand how to punctuate however than I do on almost any other usage issue. However is one of the most common conjunctive adverbs in writing. In data from 2000 to 2009 in writing, however is 2.5 times more common than thus, 4 times more common than therefore, and 9 times more common than nevertheless. When we write, we really like the word however. Interestingly, though, however does look like it's on the decline overall in writing.